The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
3 out of 4 Americans say we're on the wrong track. In fact, this number, never before in our poll, has this wrong track number been over 70% for this long. It's been nearly a year now. 58%, by the way, say America's best years are behind us. That's an all-time high in our poll.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, good afternoon. That is really a very telling poll. I want to talk a little bit about that coming up in just a second. I'd love to get your take, too. Where are we as a nation? Do you think we're on the right track? Are our best days behind us? I wouldn't agree with that, but the number to get in anytime, 888-914-9149. That was a recent NBC poll that Americans are angry and worried about the direction that we're headed. Hey, it's good to be with you. Before I go anywhere, we're back to content. I can't wait to just dive into some of the big stories today. In fact, my producers today and I, we met as we do every morning. We've got a great week coming up for you. There is some really interesting things that you need to be aware of, and we'll get you plugged in. And I want to thank everybody last week who I know donated and then donated again. I mean, the giving has just been off the chart. We hit our goal, in case you didn't hear last Friday. Just as I was signing off the air, I think we're about 80 grand short of it. By 9, 10 o'clock later that evening, we had struck goal. And over the weekend, thanks to the generosity of many people who heard the rebroadcast, the support continued to come in. So that will help us many, many months into the future and allow me to be here for you. And so many of the other great shows. I heard Father Simon thanking you as he was signing off. Don't forget, too, the chaplet's coming up in an hour. And that is such a grace and such a gift to so many. If you've donated, you made that prayer possible. And that prayer is changing lives. So thank you for whatever you can do. If you didn't donate, by the way, maybe you were out. Maybe you were traveling. Maybe you said, oh, my gosh, it's the pledge drive. And I get that. Believe me. Believe me, I totally get it. I was sharing a story last week how my son... you know, he listens to all sorts of stuff. And I guess he was tuned in to NPR, and NPR came on with their pledge drive, and like he was groaning about it. I'm like, you know, their listeners support it. So, I mean, you may not agree with them, you know, but they've got to do it. They have to do it. So, anyway, we have to do it too. And this is your ministry as much as it is mine. And we're in this together. So, thanks for what you did. Hey, let's talk about where we are too, because part of what Relevant does here, I think, is try to shine a light on. You know, the moral challenges of the day, the way we can rise above those and fulfill the vision of our founding fathers to be a virtuous people and to be a great, you know, a great nation as this nation was intended. You know, I think every decade has its challenges. No doubt about it. You can turn the hands of time back and you can look at the 80s or go back to the late 60s or go back to the Second World War. I mean, just keep, you can go throughout the decades and you'll see there's challenges. Are we any different? I think we might be. And I'd never have seen the amount of evil in a culture as I do today. From, you know the murder of children in the womb to now the murder of the elderly. It's common. To this whole transgender confusion issue, to redefining marriage, to all the things we go through. And I won't, you know, batter you with that litany as you often hear. Are we on the wrong course? I would say yes. You know, in one respect, I would say the moral direction of this country, we've lost God in this country. We stripped him from every institution we have practically. And we worship false gods today. Those gods of relativism and materialism and atheism and, you know, sex and so many other things. I think the spirit of relativism is the most predominant God that is worshipped at today. But I'm not here to bring you down. I'm not. Are our best years behind us? A lot of people said, yes, I don't buy that. I don't believe that at all. I think America is destined for greatness. And I don't think it's too late. We're already seeing the battle being raged and life beginning to win once again. Just as slavery was vanquished, life will once again reign in this country. We need prayers for our country. No doubt about it. When the NBC anchor Chuck Todd said on Meet the Press yesterday, 21% of adults say that they are headed in the right direction. Just 21%, 3/4 of Americans saying we're in the wrong direction. That should give us all pause and say, well, what can we do to get this right. You know, Chuck noted the history of the poll. You know, the number of people who think we're on the wrong track has never been above 70% for this long, which is, I think, for nearly a year now. You know, it could be a month, could be a couple weeks, could be a couple months. I mean, a year? I think it's the policies that we have enacted. It's this garbage that we're pushing. Will it change with another administration? I don't know. It depends who gets into office, right? Are they moral? Are they going to defend life and the human person? Are they going to be rational? Are they going to advance common sense? Are we going to go down this weird rabbit hole into, as my colleague Patrick Madrid likes to say, his clown world? Another 58% say America's best years are behind us, which is an all-time high. It's an all-time high. I just don't believe that. The only thing that's going to resolve all this is really God's grace. You know, and I know that Pope Francis consecrated the world to the Immaculate Heart and to Our Lady. And I think that grace is at work. And I think great things are looming, not just for Russia and Ukraine, but I think for this country as well. You know, there is a lieutenant governor. Have you ever seen Lieutenant Governor Winsom Sears of Virginia? I love this lady. I love her story. I love her heart. If you're wondering what it means to be on the wrong track, you know, Governor Sears of Virginia has part of that picture. She told Maria Bartiromo on Fox News. She did some Sunday morning feature. She says the state of education in our country has reached the level of a national security crisis. So I'm going to go ahead and actually drill into this a little bit later in the week. We should lead the world. We should lead the world. Unfortunately, we're not. A few days ago, CNN sat down with U.S. Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona. Take a listen to this.
America is facing a shortage of teachers, educators leaving the field in droves with few ready to replace them. And for many, they say it's just not worth it. Joining us now is the Secretary of Education, Miguel Cardona. Sir, thank you so much for being with us. I know you're hearing this from teachers. They have a myriad number of reasons why they are, you know, leaving. Are we at a crisis level here?
You know, I mentioned across the country, we're at the doorstep of a crisis. And if we don't take it seriously, we're going to be facing what we experienced during the Omicron spread, where our teachers didn't have COVID, but they had to quarantine and we couldn't keep our schools open. Look, across the country today, students are preparing or are going into school for the first day. There's so much promise, so much hope. And I'm excited about this school year. But we have to address this issue head on. We have to make sure that our teachers are getting a competitive salary. You know, teachers make 20% less than college graduates in other professions. And in states like Montana, for example, a starting salary is $32,000. What are you going to do with that? You know, that's why, as your clip showed, teachers have to get other jobs. They're driving Uber on the weekends. That's unacceptable in this country with teachers with a master's degree to have to do that. They bent over backwards for our students these last couple of years and before. We need to make sure we're honoring our educators, paying them a competitive salary, but also providing them working conditions where they can grow and feel heard as we reimagine our schools.
Imagine. All right. I think they're just saying to Maggie, reimagine. You know, Governor Sears said, you know, when you look at how badly our kids are being educated compared to the peers of China and Russia, she said that even kids in Estonia are doing better than our kids in math. Now, why is that? I don't have the answer for that. I am going to look into that a little bit later in the week. We'll take a look at it. This has become a national security issue because our kids can't do things like math and science, and we're going to be no match for our adversaries. That's why it's such a danger. Is it the teachers? I don't know if it's teachers. I don't think that's the problem. Is it all these devices that kids have access to now? They're constantly playing video games, watching different things, being distracted in the digital. As academics, you know, not become a priority? I don't know. I'm going to look into it. And if you're a teacher, I'd love to get your take on that too. But we're going to take a look at this because, you know, when so many of our children aren't learning, Governor Sears says, she says, we're in trouble. Lieutenant Governor. We need STEM education. She says, heavens, we need children who can just read and write. How about that? And they can add 1 plus 1. We don't have that. So I'm going to credit her for calling this out. I hope there'll be a lot more attention put on this as well. I think it's really, really important. If you want a little bit of good news, though, in the middle of all this negative news, look to Catholic organizations that are helping people get food. Catholic News Agency reported that there was a food bank in St. Louis. They saw its monthly grocery bill more than double in recent months. In fact, in Chicago, the Mission of Our Lady of the Angels Food Pantry said the number of families there seeking help, check this number out, it increased by 50% since last summer, 50%. And one of Louisiana's largest food banks is reporting that the number of needy people seeking its services, that's increased by 5% every month. So Catholic charity organizations in both Nashville and Gallup, New Mexico, they've told, I think it was CNN, that their food pantries have seen a major increase in demand since the start of the year. So thanks be to God that they're there. If you can donate, if you can help, if you can volunteer, please do that. I often think of the great command that our Lord gave us, right? One of the great corporal works of mercy, we're called to feed the hungry. So if you can help them out by volunteering or contributing or praying, whatever you can do, please do. All right, just putting that on your radar. This is America. We shouldn't see those food lines that long. You know, last week, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, she's a, I'd call her a liberal Republican. She made it to the November ballot in the last Frontier States primary. And the reason she made it, is it because she's popular with voters? Because she's really not. She only had a 46% approval rating this month. And that obviously is better than Joe Biden's, but still not great, right? But what got her over the line and onto the November ballot was Alaska's new voting system. And I want to talk about this today. You might have heard it. It seems a little confusing. Some say it's really the way to go. What Alaska has is they now have a top four primary system and then a ranked choice ballot, right? So the idea of these systems, the way this vote is supposed to work, is to get maybe more moderate, you know, candidates onto the ballot. And the proponents believe that, you know, primary voters tend to be more extreme voters who want more extreme candidates. If you're Democratic, you want, you know, this, or you're Republican, you want that. So if you open the primary to any voter and not just party-aligned voters, more people will get out to vote. And the evidence that such a change works is thin. But it's an interesting concept of how this works, how you rank the candidates and how somebody who actually ranks second could actually win an election. I've invited Ken Cuccinelli, he's the former Attorney General for Virginia, to join us. He's also acting Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security for a couple years for the former President Donald Trump, and is now the National Chairman of the Election Transparency Initiative. Check them out at electiontransparency.org. He joins us today to just walk us through this, to explain how this ranked choice voting actually works. Attorney General, thank you for your time. I'm so grateful to have you here.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. It's an interesting, if subtly difficult, topic.
Well, you know,
voting.
Yeah, I wasn't, you know, I saw it and I'm thinking, I don't know a whole lot about that. I've been following politics for a long time and I've been looking into it for the past couple of weeks, so I thought maybe I'd educate everyone else on it. Let's start with the basics, though. The open primary, why do they even have it? And how does this top four primary that Alaska is now holding work?
So keep in mind that and people can have different opinions whether it's a good or bad thing, but the open primary approach is intended to weaken the parties. And it does. I'm in Virginia, and we have a weaker party system than in states that have closed primaries. The problem is you do see it also in many ways can abuse your constitutional First Amendment right to free association, meaning to associate with people you want to associate with. Now, of course, we're not talking about discriminating against people, for instance, like the old Democrat Jayhawk clubs, keeping black people out, right, that kind of right. thing. That's not what we're talking about. But we are talking about the right to freedom of association, of Justice Scalia said years ago, also includes the right not to associate. And that means that Republicans don't have to allow Democrats to choose their nominees. And in open primary systems, you do get some of that going on. Each side can meddle with the other side. It's not truly the representative of the party making the nomination, at least not as cleanly or completely. And so when you see, like, Nevada is trying to do this now and Alaska has done it, when they go in this open primary direction, they're intentionally trying to reduce the power of the parties. And I don't mean like the Tweed gang in New York City. I mean of the parties on the political side, on the outside of government, and their ability to represent. And it's typically sold as, gee, we want to get less extremists in there. But the reality is what it does is it reinforces the establishments on both sides of the aisle. It's very pro-institutional, and it is very much structured to keep out new ideas or sudden changes, regardless of where they come from. And it does that, but it's a complicated way of doing it once you get to ranked choice voting. But you asked about open primaries, so I'm going to stop there and we can keep chatting.
You know, that's fine. I appreciate that. Let's talk about how ranked choice voting actually works, because if you've got these four candidates, right, you're supposed to rank them, well, one through four, or one, two, three, four, and so on. And your vote can help, you know, it can help your top choice win, but maybe the second person gets even more votes because everybody says, I don't really care for them. They're more moderate, but I had to go with them. I'd vote for this person. So number two might get elected, even though, you know, you'd really like to see one. That's very base in the way I just described it. Maybe explain it in greater detail for us if you could.
Yeah. So I'll take my own governor's race. The one of my races that I lost was about 47 to 45. And there was a 6.5-7% vote getter in there. And so the question becomes, do you want to let the plurality winner win one? That's one option. Right. Another option is, do you want to have a runoff like they do in some states, usually to get over 50%? But in primaries, for instance, North Carolina will do it for people over 40%, just to make sure somebody's getting close to 50 as the nominee. That's just for the nomination round, not the general. And then when you get to the general election, you do rank people. Well, Ken is my first choice. Fred is my second choice. Jane is my third choice. And in my election of just three people, then the third candidate would have been dropped after the first round of balloting. And everybody who voted for him, and only the people who voted for him, would have their second choice counted as a new vote. And those votes would be distributed between me and my hypothetical opponent here, Fred. And if I won those by more than 2%, I would go from second to first and cross 50% and be elected, even though I was less people's first choice than the guy who came in second, to use your hypothetical.
Right, no, exactly.
So you kind of solve one problem and you get another one. But again, in the general election, this isn't also intended to squeeze out both liberal and conservative, basically people who are running for principles rather than positions.
Right.
And, you know, people can dispute which one works better. I would suggest that ideas matter and have consequences, and squeezing them out intentionally through your voting system may not be such a great idea. But the worst part of it is that it's a mess. It is a mess. New York City did this in their primary last spring. It took them 10 days, and they were fighting like cats and dogs because it was so confused.
Wow.
Alaska, they already take weeks to count votes because they're bringing ballot boxes literally from the Arctic Circle. And then they're counting them. And that gap in time is really very problematic, because people who we're Americans, we expect everything done yesterday kind of mentality, that's not a good thing. But the reality is paranoia starts to fill the gaps.
Yep.
And people start to wonder, well, why isn't this done yet? They must be cheating.
Right.
And both sides wonder that. And so you end up with an election where you've undermined the confidence in the outcome of the election. The analogy is to justice. It isn't just important that our justice system deliver correct outcomes. It must be seen to deliver correct outcomes. So the appearance of justice is as important to societal safety, balance, and confidence as the actual outcome is. And the same is true of elections. Yeah. Yes, they need to run right, but they also need to be seen to run right with confidence, or we won't believe that our, quote, leaders were actually elected. This is true of both sides. You know, the focus is on Trump's 2020 election, but in the four or five elections before that, it was Democrats who were the louder complainers, and it is interesting to see them calling things insurrection that they've been doing election after election, by the way.
Okay.
So this is an attractive solution that really does make things worse. It makes them sloppier, slower, more prone to error, and it dilutes the influence of real ideas in the political process.
Yeah. Ken, let's grab a call or two. I know I have you for a couple of minutes. The number, if you want to get in, you got a question about rank choice voting. The number is 888-914-9149. Chris is actually listening in San Francisco, California. Chris, hi, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, Drew. We are a city with ranked choice voting, and my question is, it was established here because in runoffs we tended to have less participation and less voter turnout, and it doesn't, and we get more voter turnout in our main general election. And it seems to be working fine out here. Yes, it's a little slower, but in the runoffs, the candidates who traditionally would have won in the ranked choice voting tend to do fairly well in the ranked choice voting as well, and there's not been too much of a difference. So can you talk a little bit about voter turnout in ranked choice versus runoff elections?
Great question. Yeah, hey, thank you, Chris.
Yeah, no, it is a great question. And when you have runoffs, Louisiana, Georgia do this. Their election day, if you will, is the first Tuesday, you know, in November. And if nobody gets 50%, then they do a runoff. And exactly as your caller said, there's typically a drop-off in participation. Other states have what I'd call a real primary process or a real nomination process before the election day. So in the summer, you know, May, June, July, August. And then those candidates advance, so you have a guaranteed final round in that first week of November, which is the way to maximize voter turnout, which I agree with your caller is very important to try to do through how we structure our elections. And that is better achieved when the last ballot is on that first Tuesday in November. So it's, you know, that's moving the calendar a little bit. Ranked choice can avoid having a runoff, but you also have people who vote, who effectively vote more than once in the election, which is, you know, a constitutional concern we haven't really gotten into here, but it's not one man, one vote.
Let's talk about the pros. Determines a candidate with the strongest support, right? It eliminates the need for multiple elections, so to speak. But the cons on the other side of that, I think it's too complicated. It also violates, as you were just pointing out, the one person, one vote. You know, what's the future of this? I'd love to get your take on that. I don't know how many states are now doing this and who's behind it. Are Republicans more in favor than Democrats?
What I find is the flaming middle is more in favor of it because they are losing in their party competitions and they're seeing this as a way to regain control in the second round of balloting. That's the power play going on.
Gotcha.
It is not used statewide anywhere other than Alaska and Maine, obviously small states numerically. Not physically in the case of Alaska, but the confusion level is very, very high where this has been used in large elections like the New York City primary. It has been a real mess. And I would note that while San Francisco's used it as well, and the caller, I accept at face value, has said that it's run pretty smoothly there. You'd be hard pressed to find too many communities where the elections are as skewed one way as San Francisco beforehand. It's not what most people would think of as competitive elections that can swing back and forth. And it's in that environment where you really undermine the confidence in the outcome. And I do believe that it is simply a matter of time before the constitutional challenge to the one person, one vote, under the one person, one vote principle that has existed for yours and my entire lifetime since the early 60s in the Carr case that the Supreme Court decided, that this could be seriously challenged. It's a pretty easy, logical case to make. It'll be interesting to see how defenders of the process try to avoid the one person, one vote trap by somehow arguing that you only get one vote when you've voted for two different people in an office where only one is elected.
Well, Ken, first of all, thank you for your time and for your insight. As the midterms approach, as generals are around the corner, I'd love to tap into your expertise. Again, I know that you are now national chairman of the Election Transparency Initiative. What is that before we let you go? I know people can find it at that website as well.
Sure. ElectionTransparency.org is where we are. And I was a former state legislator and attorney general, and helped lead Virginia's bipartisan effort to get a redistricting commission, the only bipartisan one that got through a legislature in the country. And we're trying to increase confidence in the outcome of these elections through various means, particularly reform. The reality is, as a former state legislator, I can tell you, this is an ignored topic in legislatures. It's shunted to the back because other things are sexier and more interesting. 2020 has spiked the interest level in elections, and people are realizing things like, wow, Pennsylvania is still operating on a 1937 election code? Really? They have words in their election code that don't have practical meaning anymore, given the technology. I mean, many of our states are way behind in updating and upgrading their systems and their processes. And this is really nuts and bolts stuff. It isn't R&D. By that, I mean Republican and Democrat. If you put 100 Americans in a room, probably over 80%, they'd agree on how elections should be run. It's only when those partisan stripes start coming out that things start getting more difficult. And we're all about having them run as smoothly and openly and securely as possible. Easy to vote, hard to cheat. That's what we're aiming for.
Well, keep up your good work. Again, I'm grateful for the conversation. I look forward to the next time we can spend some time together.
Glad to do it. You have a great day.
You too. That's Ken Cuccinelli, the former Attorney General, as you heard, for Virginia, right now chairman, national chairman of the Election Transparency Initiative. I need to take a short pause. I'll be right back with more when we do. A new study's out looking at the price we pay for being less social. Stay with me.
Your news. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Your news now.
We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
I know we've come a long way, we're changing day to day, but tell me, where do the children play?
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Little Cat Stevens, for you there, where do the children play? Maggie, coming up with some new bumpers, always appropriate, too, because I want to take a look right now at what's happening culturally, not just with our kids, but with people in general. The problem of being less social. Are we more social or less social today? How do you view it? Do you remember when you were growing up as a kid? You know, how many friends did you have? What did you do? How did you guys connect? Ever since COVID hit, people have been noticing the serious decline in our real social interaction. So instead of, you know, these in-person meetings that we used to always have, they get together, you know, Zoom calls. And look, they're really convenient. I don't mind Zoom at all. There are other times I like the face-to-face, but instead of working at the office or being in school, a lot of people are able to work remotely. Attendance at church, here's a big indicator. This is a really big one, is down. More people are having others do their grocery shopping for them. As a whole industry now, whole business. You ever see somebody running around the store? They've got an app. They're picking up stuff. They're delivering it to people's homes. And that is a good thing, too, especially if somebody needs it. But some people are just saying, no, I'm not going to go. Interaction you know, with our neighbors, with our community. I think it's important. Of course, these brick-and-mortar stores of all kinds are losing business because, well, people discovered the convenience of Amazon, right, of shopping online. Man, has that changed things. But COVID only worsened a situation, I think, that was already in works. More than 20 years ago, Robert Putnam, he wrote a book called Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community. And I'll share with you, I looked it up right before the show. Here's an Amazon summary of the book, okay? I just wanted to give you how they write this. Listen, quote, drawing on the vast new data that reveal Americans' changing behavior, Putnam shows how we become increasingly disconnected from one another and how social structures, whether they be the PTA, church, or political parties, have disintegrated. Until the publication of this underground work, no one has definitely diagnosed the harm that these broken bonds have wreaked on our physical and civic health. So Jeffrey Hall, who is a professor of communication studies at the University of Kansas, wrote last week in the Wall Street Journal, I saw a piece that not only are we socializing less at work, I don't know how you are. I can speak to those I know. Maybe you're socializing more. I tend to be very extroverted. But I've asked a few people. They're saying, no, I agree. We're not socializing as much as we used to. You know, we're becoming less empathetic. So instead of being focused on others, Jeffrey Hall says people are focusing a whole lot more now on what they want and what they feel. So there's a lot of talk about getting out of these toxic relationships. And you know, it sometimes seems like a relationship, you know, where a person, you know, happens to disagree with you. I know people have broken up over politics, you know, in these relationships. Talk about toxicity. I'm joined by Father Paul Sullins. He's an emeritus professor of sociology at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., a friend of the program, senior research center right now for senior research associate, I should say, for the Ruth Institute. And it's good to have him with us for some analysis and insight. Father, good to have you back.
Nice to be with you this afternoon, Drew. I guess, what are we doing now? Are we socializing? We're talking on the phone. You know, the issue here is the use of technology to connect with one another as opposed to face-to-face communication. That's what Dr. Hall's study was about. People using more social media and less face-to-face communication. But it's interesting. A very long-term trend in Western culture. People really started to get worried about it about 150 years ago with the invention of this thing called the telephone. And there were all kinds of doomsday predictions that people would never leave their homes. They would just sit and talk on the telephone. Why go out to have to meet and talk with people when you could just talk on the phone? But what they found was that there was a blip 5-10 years where people did congregate less because they'd be trying to talk on the phone, and then it started to increase. What they found was that people used the telephone to more efficiently arrange getting together. Instead of having to mail 50 people to come together for a party, you could call them on the phone, it actually increased net communication. So I don't fully buy. Yeah. For several reasons, I don't fully buy the premise of this piece. It reminds me, and you mentioned Robert Putnam's great book. Yeah. There was another book before that, I think it's still the best-selling sociological book of all time. Came out in the 1950s. It was called The Lonely Crowd by David Riesman, and it was about this same topic. What was happening, what they were afraid of, was just the opposite, was that people were becoming less what Riesman called inner-directed. That is, they had less a sense of their interior self, their purpose, their moral integrity, and they became more other-directed. The idea was that instead of finding a place within themselves that provided them meaning and purpose, they would look to other people and they'd try to imitate them and copy them. And if you think of the 1950s and the rise of consumer culture, it was a great description of that, where people would try to keep up with one another and get the same kind of car, a little better car. They'd try to show off how good they were. And religion got involved with that. People wanted to be seen as being religious and going to church and being a good person. And so there was a shallowness that came out as a result of that. One thing that I actually see as positive is that a lot of our young people today are searching for authenticity. They don't just want to hear the advertisements and the corporate crowds and just follow what other people do. They want to find out for themselves.
Well, Hall, you know, Father...
go ahead.
No, you go ahead. No, please finish your thought.
Okay, well, Hall links this piece in the Wall Street Journal to a study that comes to the exact opposite conclusion. It's his study, if you read it, concludes that people are not engaging in more social media at the expense of face-to-face communication. They're engaging in more social media at the expense of other media. And other studies have found the same thing, a group of studies from Germany particularly, that what's happening with young people is, they're on social media more, and it can seem obsessive, but what they're doing less is watching television and watching other screens. I don't know. In my generation, I was going to say, I don't know if we're in the same generation, Drew. I might be a little older, but I grew up in a day when television was the rage. People would watch 2 or 3 hours of TV a night, and that was pretty mindless, and that led to lots of, you know, social ills. And today, television watching is way down. I'm not sure that it's all a net negative.
No, I would agree with you. I would agree with you on this point, Father. You know, I think I have 2 points here. One, I do think we've lost some introspection. I think the negative side of all this electronic media and all of this connectivity, I do think people don't find quiet time for themselves, the ability to think, to process things, and they're overwhelmed. I think that's why anxiety levels are so high, and we also see depression, a lot of other things. Social media is playing a big role in all that. But to the other point of the benefit of the other, you know, aspect of the media, which I, you know, or social media, which I think is really a great thing. But I think of my wife and my sister-in-law. My wife and her sister, you know, they live, you know, 1,500 miles apart, right? We live in totally different states. And she'll use her iPhone or their iPad, and they'll FaceTime. Right. So now you have this ability, you know, so, you know, my wife will put me on, my brother-in-law is there. So the four of us will hang out. We can have a conversation. I know people do this over Zoom. And so you can actually feel more connected. Like you actually had a visit, even though the person's not physically there. So there are some benefits to this technology as well. But I'll let you pick it back up.
Yeah. Well, the other issue that I think should be really interesting to us is the role of religion in all of this, because studies have repeatedly found that people who are actively religious, that practice their religion, are not only more sociable, but they are more altruistic. Wow. They connect with people at a higher quality than people who don't, across the board. They know their neighbors more. They help their neighbors out. They're more willing to serve somebody that they don't know very well. They have richer, more wholesome connections. You mentioned earlier about people polarizing and not associating with people who have different points of view, and that is one of the real problems that religion helps to overcome. Because what studies have found is that when people are religiously committed, they're in a congregation. They feel a brother-sister relationship with other people. They often don't agree with those people about lots of different things, but they still feel a sense of community with those people. Especially, I remember one rabbi saying, you know, you may absolutely hate the person next to you in the synagogue, but when they have a birthday or when they celebrate a wedding, or when someone needs to say the morning prayers for them, you do it, no matter what you think about the person personally. I think of the passing of the peace during the Mass. And the whole point of that is not to pass the peace with people that you like, but for reconciliation, to overcome the differences and the disparities. When Jesus said, if you're coming to the altar and your brother has something against you, go get reconciled with your brother before you bring your gift to the altar. That's the sense of the passing of the peace, that we are to have a point where we're reconciled with one another. That's something that doesn't happen very much in the world today.
We
need more of. We need more of in the church, in a sense, but we really need more of in society. The bad thing about social media is it allows you to define the limits of your community by those that you agree with or exclude those that you disagree with. That's
Father,
toxic.
Hold the thought. I've got to take a short pause. When we come back, I only have a few moments with Father Sullins. If you want to get in, I'll open the phones. You can join the conversation. 888-914-9149. Love to get your perspective as well. The Chaplet of Divine Mercy is about 15 minutes away, too. So please tell others about it. Somebody who you know needs prayer. Have them join us on the station you're listening to or over the mobile app or on the website. And we'll continue to build our prayer family. And we'll be storming heaven's gates. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Tell one friend about the Chaplet of Divine Mercy.
I'm not holding a small cup, Drew. I'm holding an extra large cup.
A bucket.
Every weekday at 4 Eastern, 1 Pacific on Relevant Radio.
Hey, good to be back. We're going to pray the chaplet in about 10 minutes with you. I'll take your call if you're on hold. Thanks for joining me. If you're just tuning in, Father Paul Sullins is our featured guest this afternoon. He's an emeritus professor of sociology at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., but serves now as senior research associate at the Ruth Institute. And if you're just joining us, we're taking a look at an article that came out talking about the price we pay for being less social. You know, what effect does it have? How does social media, how does music, how does entertainment impact us individually? Humans are supposed to be social animals. Are we losing sociability, if that's a word, social? Maggie, help me out here. What am I trying to say? Sociability? There it is, sociability. Are we losing that, being social creatures, because we have this technology, or are we even more connected than we've ever been? And that's just not true. Father, it's good to have you with us today. Let me grab the phones, because I know time's going to go pretty quick. And maybe we can address some of those issues as well. Lisa is up first, and I want to take her call out of Houston. It's good to have her dialing in. Lisa, good afternoon.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Hi. Yeah, I'm kind of just listening to what you're saying and finding myself a little conflicted both ways, because I thought it would be good. I worked remote, and it was after, you know, the COVID 2020 and how that traumatized my life with my husband getting COVID and myself and almost losing him to that. It was very traumatic. And so I thought a remote job would be the answer. And I got on with the company and couldn't have felt more disconnected and isolated. And the communication was, they didn't pick up the phone. Everything was through email. Nothing was personable. It was in translation. I just felt like something was missing, and I was becoming a workaholic. I was, you know, going to my office in my house, and I didn't have to clock on until 8, and I was doing it before 8, and I was doing it after 5 o'clock. I was a workaholic. I found myself just not wanting to shut it down, because I felt like I wasn't caught up, and I was never going to be caught up. But I felt like I had to continue to work, and I felt like the communication with the company became callous, almost. Like they were becoming hard to read, because everything was remote. And I was becoming very disillusioned, and went to my mother's funeral, took bereavement at their request, because I felt unsure. I didn't know what I was feeling about this remote job, but I felt something wasn't secure. And I came back that week from bereavement. My mother was in another state, and they terminated my employment. I was shocked. I felt like, how could how could a company be so cold? And then it dawned on me, they were, it was remote. They had no connection to me.
Yeah, at least that's a great point. And Father, I'll let you follow up on hers, but it's a horrible story. I'm sorry for what you had to go through with that. Loss of a job, that can be traumatic for you as well. And, you know, others have said to me, you know, my son is working remotely too, and I tell him, look, you should show your face in the office every once in a while, because they say people who are in office, there is a connection to them, Father, and they also are the ones who tend to get promoted the most. When you're out of sight, sometimes you're out of mind. You heard Lisa's story. I'd love to get your take.
Well, it is a terrible experience that you had there, Lisa. But your point is really valid, that when you work remotely, one of two things tend to happen. Either you're at home all the time, so work becomes kind of secondary, or you're never actually home. You're always at work, and you're working and working and working. But you never get to know those people at work. You don't develop any sense of community at the office. So I'm not sure how it's going to work out as we transition to kind of these new capabilities. There are some people that just flourish working at home, and it enables lots and lots of other capabilities that weren't there before. Women who are home with their children, for example, experience being able to work remotely as a wonderful gift that allows them to kind of be more with the family at the same time that they're at the workplace. I think that's a good thing.
Right.
There are bad things too. There are pros and cons to all of it, and we don't know the net effect on productivity, and it'll probably vary by the different kinds of job. It sounds to me like you had an employer that was not didn't adapt very well to a remote workforce, because I've seen employers that go out of their way to try to develop community remotely. They'll have the remote meetings, and they'll have a structure, and they'll have supervisors that adapt to all of that. So I think that we're still in a transition maybe to that.
Well, Lisa,
not
thank
sure.
Thank you for calling and for sharing that. Father, I only have a few minutes, so let me grab another call.
Sure.
Silver Springs, Maryland is on deck. Ralph, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Father, thanks. It's a great topic. I'm congenital Roman Catholic, and I think if you walk into a Protestant church, they commune in the sense after their service. They call it fellowship, very big. We emphasize communion during the liturgy, but we do not emphasize communion after the liturgy, which is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
Catholics don't know each other.
Yeah, that's a real good point.
I agree with that. I think the fellowship is just not part of the equation, and it should be. It's crucial. Many people want to connect.
Yeah, Ralph, it's a great point, and let me just follow up on it, and Father, I'll let you respond. I had a friend who left the faith. It was a neighbor of mine many years ago, and she had been away from the church because she had an abortion. She came back to church. I convinced her to come back, but she felt nobody showed any love to her. She says, I walk in the church, I sit, I stand, I kneel. Not one person greeted me, not one person cared about me. Meanwhile, this non-denominational evangelical church was coming over, they were bringing her meals, they were watching her kids, they were doing all these things. So she actually went in, and it was really built around fellowship and support, but she grew disenchanted. I think it was her personality type, because once she became a member of the church, then they were on to somebody else trying to get them in. But there's some merit to, I think, what Ralph is saying. We communion central to our belief, but I think fellowship within the Catholic community, I think that's something we should be looking at. I don't know where the church is on that. I'm sure that they would like to see that too.
Yeah, I've seen churches that do a really good job with that, where people congregate outside the church or near the entrance of the church, and they kind of help facilitate that. And then I've seen lots of Catholic churches that don't pay any attention to that at all. But it's a really good point. It would build up the congregation and draw people into the church. When they construct new church buildings, they need to take that into account and have a large kind of foyer area that can lead naturally to a place where people could you know, get some donuts or something and stand and talk. And I've seen a number of churches that do that. It's a weakness of our culture in the Catholic Church. One thing we haven't mentioned that's really true that contributes to the loneliness or isolation of persons today is that more and more people are living alone. In many large cities, over half of the population of the city lives by themselves, isolated. And it's not just older folk whose spouses have died, but it's increasingly young folk who prefer to live alone. They spend a lot more years before they get married, if they ever do get married. And so that is one of the primary factors that's that leads to this sense of loneliness and disconnectedness in our world today.
Well, Father, I want to thank you for being with us. I know people can check you and the great work that you do there at the Ruth Institute. Best way to do this, what, ruthinstitute.com or is it .org?
.com.
All right, Father, we'll catch up. Just search for Ruth Institute, it'll pop up. That's Father Paul Solitz. Well, I got to pray the chaplain. We got a little bit of a delay here, Father. Stay with me. When we come back, the chaplain is live. We'll take your calls and we will pray. Don't go away.